you are a small country. But from the smaller countries of the north, and in countries which have no ambition of controlling the economies of the south and so forth, from the country, the small countries of the north, I have immense faith. Simply try to understand what we are saying and make your voice heard.
Ex-President Julius Nyerere, Ireland's voice is heard in a small way in Africa. Our embarrassingly modest overseas development aid program targets four countries there for priority assistance: Sudan, Zambia, Lesotho, and Tanzania. And measured by way of gross national product per person, Tanzania is the poorest of the four and one of the poorest in the world. Now, the projects supported by Ireland in these countries vary, but a good number of them are agricultural. Dairying, improved grazing, strengthening the breed, that sort of thing. Medical. In Lusaka, Zambia, we organise maternity clinics, for example. Or connected to the provision of particular services. In Lesotho, we've trained accountants. That one sounded a bit upmarket to me, but I was told that the country had no accountants, so how could even a basic economic management capacity develop? But this documentary is concerned with one project in Tanzania which is unique in Irish aid, the Kolosa District Development Plan, in which Irish Development Cooperation, the IDC, works together with the local government to upgrade the infrastructure for a community of almost 400,000 people living in 312 remote and often inaccessible villages. What are they singing about? Well, that's a few of the men of Madudumisi village thanking us for our visit. They beat out the rhythm by hitting hollow cane sticks with small twigs. They dance round in a circle, and they thank Irish Aid for bringing them a maize mill and a go-down. That's a village crop store. It took us 35 minutes to drive the 5 miles along deeply pitted mud tracks that lead from the main road to Madudumisi. The rainy season is due soon now. The village will be cut off. For days at a time, 2,100 people will be unable to leave their village and their farms. Shambas, they call them. People like Lashidi Shaibi and his wife Mona Bebi Masusa and their four girls and one boy will work in the shamba and hope that the rain which cuts them off will bring their crops to ripeness. Lashidi, a substantial farmer, told me what he grows as food crops to feed the family and as cash crops to sell for money.
Food crops we produce here at Madudumisi is maize, beans, rice and millet. And on the point of cash crop, we have got only cotton. Anyway, we produce it in a large quantity here. Large quantity. Even beans also. Sometimes we use it to on eating and forgetting money.
But when the cotton is brought to the marketing board, Lashidi is often given not cash, but a receipt to be claimed at a later date. The Tanzanian economy is under strain. The country is 10 times the size of Ireland. Its per capita product is just 1/50th of ours. In 1989, the district of Kolosa, just a small part of this nation, had a government income of a little over £500,000. Last year, the Irish taxpayer spent £1.5 million in Kolosa. We've built and equipped a trade school, constructed and strengthened roads and bridges, renovated the hospital and dispensaries, maintained a mechanical workshop for local government vehicles, and become involved in rural development and forestry. But not all without pain. And in this programme, I want to tell the story of the Kolosa project in the words of some of those involved in it, and to put into my own words some of the private criticisms of the stages of the development of what has been an important learning experience for the still infant Irish bilateral aid programme. Nelly Mwajibi works in the Irish Development Cooperation Office in Kolosa town. She married a Ugandan and lived in his country. In 1979, he died and left her with four children, whom she fed on the proceeds of running a shebeen in which she sold her home brew. In 1982, she returned to Kolosa. Irish aid to the area, which now accounts for 3/4 of all our assistance to Tanzania, was just beginning. So what was Kolosa like?
There was much changes. because I found most of the things were not in the shop, in shops, especially essential commodities like salt, sugar, cooking oil, clothes. All these things were very scarce, and this was affected by the war between Uganda and Tanzania.
Apart from the fact that there was nothing in the shops, what about the infrastructure of Kolosa? Was it good then?
The roads were very also bad, and some roads during the rain season were not passable, like Kolosa to Mikumi. It was not easy for vehicles to go down there during rain season. But nowadays, at least, it can be passable.
The Kolosa program was Ireland's response to Tanzania's request to donors to take on comprehensive development schemes in individual regions. A region was too big and expensive an undertaking for Ireland, so the district of Kolosa, where we already assisted a sisal factory and a dairy farm, was chosen. During the first phase, the biggest spending was on roads. Kolosa's geography runs from floodplains to mountain ranges. At the junction where the road through Kolosa joins the main Tanzam highway, which runs from Dar es Salaam on the coast westwards across country and into Zambia, I met up with Kieran Fitzgerald, one of the 9 Irish expatriate staff, the roads engineer, on leave of absence from Kilkenny County Council. The road has been substantially improved even since I was last on it in 1986. But in recent years, Kieran's biggest headache has been a stretch across black cotton soil, which has proved to be the biggest bar to travel in the rainy season.
The problem really starts here. This is the black cotton soil section. This is the remaining black cotton soil. Black cotton soil is something like the Irish bog, really, except that it expands by about 30% when it gets wet. So actually about 1 hour's rain on this, and it would be quite impassable. Now, over the years, there were various techniques used to get across the black cotton soil, because at this stage we have traversed maybe about 30 kilometres of it. But the main technique that was used was just building gravel embankments. That was loading, just basically loading on the black cotton and getting the road level above flood level, and also getting good camber on the roadway so that the water drained off from side to side and put in good drainage. But in this particular section, the black cotton soil is about 8 feet deep. Now, under normal circumstances, you would say, God, you, if you were in Ireland, you'd say, we'll have to dig that out, we'll have to dig that out. But it's just not tenable. It's about 6 kilometres long. We haven't that type of machinery here. We haven't even the filling to backfill when you would excavate it. So it was decided about 2 years ago to experiment with a geotextile layer, which is more or less laying a carpet on top of the existing black cotton soil, and then you need that acts as a more or less a separating layer, and it stops the mud coming up through the gravel, and by the same time the water getting down into the black cotton soil underneath. We have done approximately 3 kilometres of it, and it has been very, very successful. Very successful. We're very, very pleased with it so far.
So you're saying that 1 hour of rain and this road previously would not have been passable at all.
Yes, my driver tells of a time where he was actually stuck where we are sitting here. He was stuck for 4 days, about 3 years ago.
And he's less than an hour from home?
He's less than an hour from Kolosa, yeah. The journey from the tarmac road, the Tanzam highway to Kolosa, used to take about 6 to 7 hours, about 4 to 5 years ago. At this stage, even during the heaviest of the rains now, I would imagine it will take about maximum about an hour and a half.
Yeah, and it took us about an hour and 5 minutes to come down on a dry day today.
On a dry day, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's 80 kilometres. If you came the long way from Kolosa, it's 80 kilometres. So if you came out in an hour and 5 minutes, you're doing very, very
well. No, we took the shortcut.
You took the shortcut. Okay, it's about 70 by the shortcut. So you came out, you averaged better than, you averaged about 80 kilometres an hour. So that's not too bad on a gravel road.
But think of the hazards facing this geotextile layer. Even the rivers are liable to change course here in the rainy season. In fact, we hadn't travelled far till we came to an example.
Nobody knows what's happening underneath with the black cotton. It contains salts, so maybe there's a reaction with the geotextile layer itself. Maybe the mud is starting to come up already. It should be about 16 to 18 inches down, so we're not too sure. But if you were using this technique in Ireland, you would hope to get maybe 20 years life out of it. It might be a bit much to hope for that here, but with good maintenance on the road surface and assuming that nothing is happening underneath, I think that, yes, it would be quite successful. And it's quite an inexpensive method. It's only about it only cost us about £7,000 a kilometre, which is in marked contrast to the rest of it. Barnabas, could you stop a second now, please? Now, this is where we have the... problem with the... This river is basically just a sand river. There's only water in it for about 4 weeks of the year. And it has changed course and appeared here next to the roadway. This is within the last 2 to 3 years. And is now seriously threatening sections of this, so we're doing some erosion protection along it with stones.
And later, a river which rose over the road in the rains.
There was 2 feet of water flowing across the top of the bridge here, just at Easter last year. Some of our more daring candidates actually came in here one night at about 8 o'clock or half 8. The lads working in Kilosa, some of the Irish lads, and my God, they were lucky, because the water was actually over the lights on the Land Rover, and they went through in it.
Well, apart from the fact you could stall, you could washed away, couldn't you?
Well, they could, you see, if there's a good velocity, they could. But they were wise enough. They got some of the locals, actually, to walk ahead of the car, because the problem is, of course, that you can't see where the road is. When the water's on it, you can't see where the edge is or anything like that. And all these cross culverts that we have up along here, which are about 3 feet over the road, the parapet walls of them, they were the only things that were visible, with the tops of the parapet walls. So they could guide themselves from there. And they got some locals to walk in front of them, so it delineated the road edge for them. They were quite foolish. But
I think the locals were quite foolish for walking in front of them.
Well, the locals got paid, I suppose. I presume that the boys paid them anyway.
I hope they did. The project has upgraded 125 miles of main road. It has provided seasonal employment for up to 400 people.
It's very easy to get staff. But the wages are low. There would be the equivalent of about £6 a month would be a basic labourer's wage. Now, the problems are, of course, that the village system of government that's here, that maybe that labourer is also needed to work in the village chamber for 2 days a week or whatever. So you have to fix some sort of a fair system for him, whereby he's not penalised back in his village, and at the same time can do a decent day's work. The biggest incentive here is food, and up to now, if people work overtime, food is provided for them, and actually we find it costs more to feed them than to pay them. It's actually dearer to feed them, which begs the question, of course, how do they manage to keep their families on their basic wage? But we are actually paying the maximum. We're paying an urban rate. Some of the other areas would not be paying even that.
The job is almost complete. Then just maintenance will be needed. Irish Aid will hand that responsibility over to the Swiss in 1992 and then concentrate on 700 miles of feeder roads, which will give accessibility to villages like Matadumisi, 5 miles off the main road, which currently takes 35 minutes driving.
There was a what's called a go-down, a large store, a grain store built there. Maize mill put into the place, so it's obviously very, very productive. You could probably do the feeder road to Matadumisi in about 7 to 8 months, if the gravel, of course, is freely available up there, if it's locally available. That would be a tremendous boost to the people of Matadumisi, because Matadumisi from now on will be fairly inaccessible until about, I think, June, July. It certainly would be very, very rough. Yeah. I'd say it would be inaccessible March, April, May, it would be inaccessible.
And still they sing at Matadumisi. Their feeder road will not be ready for some time, but already they have their maize mill and the go-down is almost built. Village farmer Lashidi Shaibi on the changes to his wife's lifestyle.
We used to walk a long distance to carry our maize on our heads. It's about 20 kilometers from here. We used to go somewhere there. And sometimes my wife used it to consume a long time grinding by using local stones. We have got a type of stones which is made for grinding by using stone to stone. So that time we had a problem. But since the machine was planted here, Actually, those problems now have minimized to a great extent. There is no problem anymore.
Now, what about the go down? It's being built at the moment. I don't know when it's going to be finished. When do you expect it to be finished? And what changes do you think that will bring to your life here?
Yeah, I think we'll benefit a lot once during the completion, because preserving our crops is difficult. Also, we hadn't specifically place to sell our crops. That was another problem. So I think this go down will help us a lot, because even now, you see, maize is growing. We don't expect to keep in our homes, because in our homes there is no enough security. There is some insects that is destroying our maize, is destroying beans. It needs somewhere to store, a very safe place. So we will benefit a lot, actually.
Such simple advancements, but so important. From maize, the people make ugali, a kind of porridge, their staple diet. In Kolosa town, Nelly Mwajibi told me about the traditional work of pounding the grain, which the maize mill has reduced to a five-minute operation.
Usually before the woman come to eat, it used to take a week or 5 days, because he had to pound, to skin off the skin of the maize and soak for 5 days or even 7 days. So that the maize become soft when he comes again to pound or to grind on the stone. So after grinding and getting flour, the flour must be put again in the sun to dry before mingling it. Then after drying, then they come to eat. So it was a long process before the woman eat.
And now to go along to the maize mill takes what?
It can take even half an hour, because there is a machine for skinning and for grinding. So only 30 minutes, then you eat. If you like, you soak your maize after skinning. If you don't want, you just winnow it to remove the uchafu, the dirty things. And then you grind it again to get the flour. And then you eat. So it doesn't take you more than 1 hour.
So that's a big change in the lives of people.
Of course it is. And it has made women to feel better than pounding. Pounding is very hard, and it was wasting a lot of time to do other things, but you keep on pounding. You can use a day only for pounding, because you want to get maize meal. You want to get the flour to eat. So you have to use the whole day to do that job.
Well, take me through a day in the life of a woman. In 1980, sometime around about 1980, before any of these improvements came, what time would a woman get up at? What would she do for the day? Take me through her day.
After she goes to sleep. Mm. It depends, woman to woman. Some, after getting up, if it is during cultivating, she goes to shamba. She cultivates there. After that, she will look for firewood. After that, she will look for some vegetables. Then she goes home. There at home, she sweeps her house and she goes to fetch some water, because normally water is not in the house. It is a bit far, so he has to go there and fetch some water and come back and start preparing her vegetables. After that, she cooks some ugali. After eating, she washes her things. After that, if she has got something else to do, she goes on. She goes to something else to do. If he has got some washing, I mean clothes, she will go and wash them. In fact, it takes the whole day for a woman to be busy.
And what has changed now? Do you think that life has become better for many people in this district over the past 8 years?
Of course, as we go, changes becomes. Every year, there are changes. We see some changes for life. For example, water. If water was very near 5 years ago, but now there are some wells. Some white people also came and helped us with pumping water. So water is just near. We don't fetch from rivers. We fetch from pumping method. So we can see.
So that saves a lot of time?
Yeah, it saves a lot of time.
For women and also for daughters?
For women, daughters, even for men, because you can go for water and waste a lot of time there, and when you come back, you find your husband has become very annoyed because you have delayed there. So he might be thinking something else, which is not true.
What would he be thinking?
Perhaps you had another man there.
I'm sure the improvements brought by Irish Aid are not threatening family life. But life for the people, 85% of whom live by subsistence farming, continues to be hard. And it can be hard, too, for the Irish expatriates who come to live among them. Colossa Town has 4 houses for those expats. At the moment, there are 2 families who are coming to the end of their attachments. 2 more people, a mechanic and a rural development worker, have just arrived. Much of their socialising has to centre around each other, and between former occupants there have been some tensions. There has also been divided counsel on how the job should be done on occasions, and that has led to some wastage. Not every pound has been well spent. At times there's been a nervous relationship with the local administration, some members of which have become a little aid-dependent. And there have been difficulties over the Makumi Vocational Training Centre, to which we'll come. But let's move now to Colossa Hospital, which in 1986 was in as bad a state of disrepair as almost any I've seen in Africa. The windows were broken, there was no mosquito gauze, the bed sheets were torn, the mattresses were unclean. Assistant District Medical Officer Dr. Shaban Mkambila told me about the basic health problems of the area.
The main problems which we are facing in the district, malaria is one of the commonest diseases. It kills the under-5s and even others get this problem of malaria. And number 2 among the top 10 diseases includes upper respiratory tract infection. Number 3, anemias. They get anemias from malaria, of course.
What then are your feelings about the Irish assistance to the hospital and to the dispensaries?
We are very happy and we have really appreciated the IDC assistance because, as I said, our hospital was a very bad one. Most of the buildings, you know, they had been built up a long time ago, 1923. But at the moment, they are real good buildings now.
But there is a necessity, would you believe, for that assistance to continue?
Yes, of course. We need it badly.
The wards have mostly been rehabilitated by this stage. There's been a problem with the kitchen where the smoke blows back inwards. That'll have to be reworked. It's still far from what would be acceptable in Ireland, but the improvement is appreciated. One element of the Irish project which is structurally very much up to what would be acceptable here is the vocational training centre at Makumi at the southern end of the district. All 105 students chant as they jog around the campus. It's called the Mchaka Mchaka. It's a daily ritual before they begin their studies as motor mechanics, fitters, carpenters, joiners, or construction workers. Jerry Ryan from Foss in Limerick is the project manager.
It's tremendous to see the enthusiasm with which they approach the whole task here. They will start in the morning at before 6 o'clock and they will go for a jog, the Mchaga Chaga, as they call it here, for about 20 minutes. They'll then have a shower, have breakfast. Formal classes will start at 7:30 sharp. So they assemble for a roll call just in front of us here, beside the flag. After a roll call, then they're straight into the workshops and they'll work through until 2:30 in the afternoon. A short break in the afternoon, then they will do some agricultural work, and they'll have study again in the evening from something like 8 to 9:30. And then it slides out 10 o'clock and up at 6 the following morning.
If the students live an ordered life, their college has had a less predictable development. It should have been a local tech, part of a national plan for such trade schools. Instead, it has been built like a national third-level institution, dominating the side of a hill just outside Makumi, spacious and luxurious and built at a cost which far exceeded the original intentions of the Department of Foreign Affairs. It seems the first Aries project leader had dreams beyond those of his Ivy House masters, who in turn left to him to get on with it. It's claimed that the financial controls over the whole Colossa project have been tightened since then. According to Michael O'Mara, the building skills instructor who's there now, building into the rock was slow and expensive. But the facility is now almost complete. So what purpose does it serve?
The brief that we had coming in here was that these were people recruited from the villages to go back to the villages to carry out building. In the villages, they have a difficulty in so far as... A village might be the wrong term, because a village... I visualise a village as being a group of houses together. The village can be very, very scattered over a wide area. Now, farming is becoming more intensive here. The production, land, the yield from land is becoming better. They need godowns, what we call godowns, which are food stores and this kind of thing. And the idea is that the young people will come here, learn how to build from locally available raw materials. This includes stone, which is freely available at very, very little cost throughout the region and the district. But also matafali, what they call matafali, which is burned brick, which they make themselves. And this is, again, a very cheap material and it's available throughout the district. Timber is available throughout the district. And in most cases, at village level, they fell the timber themselves and put it together. So our brief on the construction course is to teach or train a person how to build a simple structure, putting in stone foundations that will not be attacked by insects, raising the walls either of stone or of matafali, of brick, putting on a roof, making a door, making a window, or several doors or several windows. So at the end of a two-year period, they're able to make a simple structure. Now, the training has been geared toward that particular objective, how to make a simple structure, so that when they go back to their villages, they will be able to make simple structures. In the villages at the present time, traditionally, they built from mud, of clay and wattle made, as the poet said in Ireland one time. And but these are just stakes put into the ground, which are inevitably eaten by termites. The wind blows, the rain comes, the mud becomes liquid again, and the house floats away. They need solid structures, particularly where food storage is concerned, where dispensaries are concerned, and these kind of things. At this stage, the young people have built all of these things. What they're really doing now is practicing, getting a little bit better, building up their speed.
Headmaster Walter Shahidi says even the national newspapers say Makumi Trade School is the best of its type. In what way?
This training centre, comparing to other training centres in Tanzania, it seems to be the best. And there was an article in the 23rd of December in the Daily News, which is the main newspaper. And a journalist from the Radio Tanzania of Dar es Salaam inspected the school, and they think that they wrote that this is the best training centre, equipment-wise and the teaching standards.
So what has it got? What is it that makes it different from the others?
It has got most of the training materials. Most of the training centres, vocational training centres, have not got enough training materials. Therefore, the students are not properly trained, and they haven't got reliable instructors. Instructor keeps leaving the school, and everything is disrupted. But this training centre is running smoothly. It has enough training materials for students to do their skills.
Are there any difficulties that you come across in being principal of a training center which has got an input both from the region, the district and the region, and obviously central government, and also a foreign donor?
Yeah. The problem which I have at the moment is that the Irish folks are contributing the major part, 90% actually, for 1990, and the district is supposed to contribute 10% with the help of the central government. And the district's contribution last year was to be 1.2 million shillings, and they only contributed 300,000 shillings. So they contributed one quarter of what they should contribute. In other words, one quarter of their 10%. And this year they're supposed to contribute 20. Now I'm worried that if they couldn't contribute more than a quarter of a 10%, how are they going to make for the 20%?
So in effect, you survived last year on 92.5% of what should have been your budget.
Yeah.
And that what effect does that have? What do you lose out on by not having that extra section of your budget?
I lose in the fact that I have to cut corners. I have to cut down expenses and try to survive slim. And also, sometimes I end up carrying up debts into the next year, which should have been paid last year.
And that could be a deteriorating situation, obviously, if they pay just, you know, a small percentage of the 20% this year.
Yeah, I don't expect them to be able to raise any substantial amount in the future, because their collection, the amount of collections they make, is so meager compared even to the amount of the expenditure, and their commitment is in question at the moment. And there is a review team recommended by Fintan Farrelly's and John Grindle's research from Ireland, who came down here, and they're recommending that a review team be set up to address the future training needs of this centre, the future relationship of this centre in the whole network of vocational training centres in Tanzania, and funding.
The Wise Men Committee, as it's called, must decide how best to integrate Mikumi Trade School into serving Tanzania's needs. It seems it must be made more of than was originally intended. But already the government is failing to reach the level of contribution it was intended to make, and just to call it a national institution but fail to provide the necessary funds would leave it as a white elephant on the outskirts of a national park which has its share of real elephants. Let's visit the area and its history with Michael O'Mara.
About 700 metres in that direction there, which is slightly north of where we're sitting, is the official boundary of Mikumi National Park. Mikumi National Park is about the size of Munster. It's at the tip of the northernmost tip of the Selu, or Zealous Game Reserve, which is as big as Ireland, virtually. It's probably the biggest game reserve in the whole world. There's all the large animals are there, the hippos and the elephants and so on. We've got lions. And indeed, where we're sitting now, I came up here one morning, and just out there, maybe 10 yards away from where we're sitting, there was a leopard sitting there. We've had lions on the site here. We've had hyenas on the site, we've had impala on the site, we've had zebra on the site. Not so much now, because we're getting a little bit more developed and we're clearing the bush back towards the national park, and that gives us a buffer zone. It's a very interesting area to be in. A thing that surprised me very much when I came here was when the students came in from the villages, which were around the Kolosa district, many of them had never seen an elephant. Many of them had never seen a zebra. So one of the things we do early on in the course is bring them out for a trip to the national park, and they're quite amazed at these animals out here that they've heard of but have never seen in their life before. And they talk about this for days afterwards. And if we see lions, of course, the lion is the big one. They can talk for this months afterwards, and they always want to get their picture taken with a lion. And Mikumi is an interesting place otherwise. It didn't exist really 30 years ago. If you can imagine a line going from north to south, at the top of that line was a town called Kolosa, which is the district seat, if you like, the county town, as we might call it in Ireland. And then at the bottom of the line, you have a town called Ifikara, which is a dead end. When you get there, all you can do is turn around to come back, because there's big swamps down there. You're into Zealous at that stage. And then somebody came along and they built the road across the middle of it, which they called the Tanzam Highway, the Trans-Tans. This is the road that was built with copper money to get the copper out of Zambia up to the port of Dar es Salaam for shipping out to the rest of the world. When that road came in, it formed the crossroads. at a little village. Well, it wasn't a village at the time, but they called it Doma. And there was a river there, and there was a small ford there, not a bridge as there is now. But the river used to flood, so somebody decided that it's not a good place to have a village. So they moved the village about a mile to the east, and that is now Makumi, where we are there. It's just sitting down there behind us. That was the late 50s, early 60s. The reason there was never a town or a village here was because, if you can imagine the Indian Ocean being over there on your right-hand side someplace, and Zanzibar and Pemba and a town called Bagamoyo, these were the centres of the slave trade for 1,000 years up to the late last century. And the slave route came from Dar es Salaam westwards, in as far as a large town called Morogoro, through a town called Shilinzi, which is the road to the north, and Kilimanjaro. And then it continued further westward because to a town called Kolosa. If it had gone, we'll say, slightly south of that, it would have gone into Makumi National Park, the Badlands, where there's tsetse fly particularly. People didn't live there because of the tsetse fly. They couldn't keep cattle there. There's a lot of swamps there. The place is flooded quite a lot. It's a good crocodile area. And in general, people didn't live there. So it was just a big, empty area. Then they built the Tanzam Highway through it. So suddenly people had access to this area. North of the road, they made Makumi National Park. South of the road is now Salu. And so traditionally, there's never been people in this area. But when the crossroads came, people suddenly came to this area. And in the early 60s, about 1965, the Catholic Church came in, the Carmelites, and they built a mission. And they opened a school there. And about 1966, there were 7 people attended the school. Now you've got nigh on 2,000 children going to school between the two villages, Doma and Kidoma and Makumi. The population here has exploded. Not because of the availability of land, because to the west, to the east is Makumi National Park, and they can't put in crops there because the wild animals will come in and eat the crops. To the south are the Wazunga Mountains, and it's bad farmland. They can't farm there. So what people tend to do when they come to Makumi, and I must say there's no single tribe in Makumi, there are many, many different tribes from parts of Tanzania. What they do is tend to be traders, catering to the traffic that is moving between Zambia and Dar es Salaam. At the present time, we've got 2 petrol depots here where petrol is bought and diesel is brought from Dar es Salaam as far as Makumi, deposited there in great big tanks, and then other lorries come from Mbeya and further west to take it down there. We have a railway station at this stage. This is the new school that has come into Makumi. There's a new hospital being built here. The bank has just opened up a few months ago here. There's a post office there. There's actually a telephone now at this stage. But it's still a village, very much a village. A mixed gathering village, essentially to cater for the traffic on the Tanzam Highway. There's no slave route anymore, but it is said that Speke and Burton and all these people, they came through here and slightly north of here. At Kisanga, which is about 10 miles away from where we're on. That was the old slave route. And you can actually follow the slave route by looking at the trees. There's huge mango trees all along the slave route because the Arabs used to put in these trees to feed the slaves so there would be fruit along the way. And wherever you see now a big, old, established mango tree, that's the slave route that you're on at the present time. You'll see them on the way back to Dar es Salaam probably when you come to Morogoro.
The slaves, a thing of the distant past. And at the trade school, 105 trainees, hoping their government and our government continues to provide the necessary funding. The Wise Men Committee has a job in front of it. The Tanzanian economy is going backwards. The Irish Aid Programme hopes to raise the trade school and the rest of the Kolosa project to the point of sustainability and then move on. So let's hear the views of some of the people I met on sustainability. Tom Redmond is coming to the end of his spell as administrator of the whole project.
It will take a little while longer, I would think. I mean, it's not something that will be over in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. We're trying to build up the management within different areas within the district, but that will take some time.
Is there any chance of an aid dependency developing here, and that people here would say, well, it's all right so long as the Irish stay?
There is always a danger, I think, in any aid project that there will be the dependency on the aid agency. What we try and do is it's not only IDC funding the projects, there is a kind of self-help projects which the villagers themselves supply the bricks or whatever, and the district would supply the labourers. But there is always that danger, but we're trying to get away from that.
Kolosa businessman Abdallah Senkubu fears even for the roads.
If the aid stops immediately, maybe after a year or 2 years, continuation of maintaining the roads to be as it looks now, no, it won't be easy. It will drop down and then we will lose our hopes that the district is developing for the roads on that, because now it is too costly.
Nelly Mwajibi says part of the answer is in the hands of the people.
I think we better also, we people ourselves, do more work instead of being lazy. Because some people are very fond of loitering, doing nothing. Sometimes even in the office, some people are doing nothing. They waste time on other things. They go out and do their own things there instead of doing government job.
Well, on government salaries, most people have to find some outside project to feed their families. Kieran Fitzgerald is more hopeful. Just
up until this year, I would have said no, because they certainly didn't have adequate funding to carry out a proper maintenance system on them. But this year, I see a glimmer of hope, because the money that has been made available from the regional offices seems to me to be adequate to fund the operation. Now, the other side of sustainability, of course, is are the people capable of carrying out the work? That is a problem. It is a big problem area. There is an enormous amount of training has to be done. And unfortunately, there aren't facilities in Tanzania at the moment to carry out this type of work. But it is in train. The International Labour Organization are starting off some training schools. There is one in Kenya, but unfortunately, it is very, very difficult to get entry into it. So that side of thing is being looked after, but it probably will take a few years. It probably will take maybe 3 to 4 years to get a properly funded and properly set up training institution. If both happen together, if we have proper training and adequate funding, yes, it is sustainable.
The Kolosa project has had its problems, but it has taught lessons to Irish Development Aid. To be involved in a broadly based programme is in itself arguably more challenging than sticking to smaller, more confined projects. The work so far has increased economic activity in Kolosa. In the coming years, primary schools in the district will benefit from the programme so that it reaches those most in need. At present, the schools have sufficient desks for only one-third of their pupils. 4 out of 5 classrooms have no blackboards. The needs at every level are immense. Irish Aid has learned more about working with an African national and local administration, and the people of a whole district have learned something about the Irish taxpayers' contribution to the interdependence of the world. Makumi Headmaster Walter Shaidi.
Oh, they are very, very much aware, and they very much appreciate that, because even a common man in Makumi, in a pub, would be talking about how will this project be when the Irish people leave. You know, they're very aware that the success here is because of the Irish taxpayer. And people are saying that, oh goodness me, when the Irish leaves, it will be a big problem. We cannot probably manage. How are you going to manage? You know, they keep talking about that thing. And it's so much central to this project that everybody knows that it's the Irish taxpayers' money which is doing this. And they're wondering what we are going to do when eventually the Irish people have to pull out after so many years. Everybody's asking, when are they pulling out? And they're saying, we hope they won't pull out for the next, say, 10 years or so. They regard their participation as very, very vital to this project.